What does motion sound like? With Kizik Hands Free Shoes, it sounds a little something like this. Experience the magic of motion. Get a free pair of socks with your first order at kizik.com/socks.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hi, this is Laura Stark at Vanderbilt University. I had the pleasure to talk with Arlene Tuckman about her award-winning book, Diabetes, A History of Race and Disease, out from Yale University Press in 2020. As you'll hear, our interview is a collaborative effort with students in my course, American Medicine and the World. The book tells the American history of a disease that continues to defy categorization. Researchers for more than a century have worked to create distinctions between types of diabetes to parse people who all share the trait of high levels of sugar in their blood. Tuckman shows how efforts to divide diabetes into types tracked efforts to divide people into different types, specifically by race. For Tuckman, this move reflects an American obsession with race that too often overlooks racism as a fundamental cause of disease. The book won the 2022 Rosen Prize from the American Association for the History of Medicine and will be of immediate interest for folks who are also interested in science and technology studies, American history, and social justice. I hope you enjoyed the conversation. So this is Laura Stark at Vanderbilt University with students in the course American Medicine and the World, and we're very happy to be talking today with Arlene Tuckman, who is the author of the award-winning book, Diabetes, A History of Race and Disease, which won the Rose Medal from the American Association for the History of Medicine in 2022. And so the book is about diabetes. And diabetes, as many people know, is typically in the present day divided into two forms known as type 1 and type 2, or juvenile diabetes and other types of diabetes. But what you point out early on in the book is that actually there's a lot of ambiguity about these categorizations in the first place, all to just mark instances in which there's a high level of sugar in people's blood. But the categories themselves have changed substantially over the past 100 years. And so you start readers off with this question of just why bother trying to categorize if the categories keep shifting around? Like, what is driving this impetus to categorize? So to start us off, could you just say a word about how you go about answering this question? If you had to kind of boil it down, why are people insisting on creating categories?
Well, I think that we're all always creating categories. It's one of the ways in which we create meaning. Otherwise, everything is just all blurry. So really what I'm doing in the book is asking why these categories and why not other categories? I've basically written a cultural history of diabetes. I've looked at the question of who has been considered most at risk of developing diabetes and why. And I trace how that answer has changed over roughly 120 years. And the categories that I found, or But the main category that I found that has most often been employed to make sense of this question is categories of race. So what the book does is to trace how the answer to this question of who gets diabetes and why, who is most susceptible, that there has always been one population, one racial population that has been labeled most susceptible, but that has changed radically over the last 120 years. So the book starts by looking at when diabetes was considered to be a Jewish disease, and it traces it through a significant number of different changing populations. So from a Jewish disease to largely a white middle class disease to the disease of Native Americans. And then by the 1980s, the categories really are the ones that still surface today. So if you look at any of the major websites to see which populations are considered most likely to develop diabetes, then you'll read Native Americans, African Americans, and Latinx populations.
Yeah, it seems as if the categories for diabetes shifted as as ways of categorizing human beings shifted as well, and thinking about the racial classification. So efforts to categorize people were sort of tacking on to these the transitions in categorizing forms of diabetes as well. So, I mean, we found the reasoning for taking diabetes in particular, so answering the question of why this disease, I found it really compelling in that there wasn't just one important shift that we can see historically, but the categories kept changing. There was a number of times in which the categories changed. But in addition to that, there's a really personal connection for you as well to the story of diabetes. And here I'm going to hand it over to Chase.
Yeah, so the book starts with your connection to diabetes and your dad. So how would you say that your connection to the disease affected how you approached writing the book?
Yeah, you know, so of course I looked at a number of the questions that you had posed ahead of time, and I have to say that this question stumped me a little bit more than the other questions, which I have to say is a little embarrassing, because you'd think that I would have down pat the answer to this question, or that I would have spent a lot of time thinking about exactly how my close relationship to a family member who had the disease would have shaped the writing. But in thinking about your question, it made me realize that the negative stereotypes that we all have come to associate with diabetes, and there were negative stereotypes through time, that they had very little impact on my dad. And I thought more about this, and part of it was just his personality, because he just did not care what other people thought about him. So even had I witnessed him being confronted by negative stereotypes, it wouldn't have mattered to him, but I didn't. So I think it's also because my dad had what I call in the book, you know, the good diabetes. Although he didn't start out that way. So when he was diagnosed with diabetes in his mid-60s, doctors believed that he had type 2 diabetes, which is what I grew up calling adult onset. And he was a little plump at the time. So when he was in his mid-60s, so it actually made sense. It fit the kind of signs and symptoms that doctors associate with that form of the disease. But it turned out that he had an unusual form of diabetes, late onset autoimmune diabetes. And he lost a huge amount of his body weight within about a year and a half. And so it turned out that his body really wasn't producing any diabetes. Any insulin. But when my dad had trouble controlling his diabetes, and he did, he had what was also known as brittle diabetes, although there are members of the medical community who claim that that category does not exist. But when he had trouble controlling his diabetes, nobody blamed him. Like, I never saw anyone take him to task. And I think it was because, well, he was very elderly. Well, not when he was in his mid-60s, but he lived until his early 90s. Because he was elderly, because he was white, and because he was thin, he was tiny. So I the best I can say is that, you know, in thinking about your question, that it probably sensitized me to the unfairness of blaming others who also had trouble controlling diabetes, but through no fault of their own. So I think that's the best I can do, but I'm happy with the follow-up question if that doesn't satisfy.
Yeah, one of the most, I think, moving or surprising sentences in the book for many of us was the last sentence of the introduction when you write, "My father had his faults, but no one blamed him for his diabetes." And it was such a perfect, like, daughter's commentary on a parent.
Yeah, he was not an easy man.
But it was also sort of pointing the way towards what you're showing us is one of the big impacts of the ways in which diabetes has been categorized. And you've referred to it a little bit already of thinking about the good diabetes and the bad diabetes, and the idea of your dad being blamed and people being blamed for their illnesses or not being blamed. And to the extent that he was coded as a lean white man really factored in whether he was considered blameworthy, and therefore it was an issue of lifestyle choices that he was responsibilized for changing. And I feel like it's all the more interesting to observe because in the first chapter you tell readers about the history of understandings of diabetes as a Jewish disease.
Right.
You also write about your own, you know, your father coming to town for your own son's bar mitzvah and these sorts of things. So there's this remarkable story of your dad as a Jewish man and the Jewish the understanding that diabetes was associated with negative attributes of people who were Jewish.
Negative and positive.
So say more.
So one of the startling discoveries that I made in the course of writing this book was that it wasn't simply that the racial categories changed, but that in the first half of the 20th century, diabetes was also considered to be a disease of civilization. So yeah, I mean, no one wanted diabetes. And yet, and there were all these negative stereotypes associated with it, lifestyle, obesity, and these judgments. And I mean, Jocelyn, and I know this will come out in another question, but Jocelyn actually talked about diabetes as being a penalty of obesity. So there are these negative associations, but at the same time, it was considered to be a disease largely of whites. Jews were considered to be white and of civilized people. And the simplest explanation of that would just be that it was in developed populations that people ended up living long enough to develop diabetes and other diseases of civilization. But it became very coded with sort of bourgeois modes of disciplining bodies. So there was the negative, but there was also the positive association. And when, after World War II, as diabetes became associated with populations of color, the disease gradually lost its association with being a disease of civilization and became a disease of primitive populations. So that was, it was startling to me when I was able to map that transition placed over the way in which the racialized category shifted.
One of the most stunning things in the first chapter on the history of diabetes as a Jewish disease for me was reading about one scientist's efforts to trace the ancestry. So thinking about these biological notions of race to sort of a farther Eastern origins of Jewish populations so that Jewish people could be considered under the Chinese Exclusion Act and immigration could be restricted. And so seeing how that was so closely tied to xenophobia of the early 20th century was really stunning. And then in the second chapter, thinking about the Johnson-Reed Act, which I think is one of the most remarkable historical documents, and I'm so glad people work on this, with the concept of a dictionary of people, where you really start seeing the federal government in the United States creating these very firm policy relevant ideas about who counts as white. And that's when Jewish people were officially decided to be white. It was just really remarkable. So here, I want to hand the question, the floor over to Parwan to think more about how, what we should make of these sorts of scientific forms of evidence.
Yeah. You discussed the tendency for doctors to make incorrect assumptions regarding the underlying causes of disease. How has your research changed your opinions on the credibility of scientific claims?
Yeah, thank you. So I have to say that I was not surprised by what I found in my research for this book, because as an historian of medicine and science, I've been trained to look for the assumptions that that scientists and physicians and people in the healthcare community bring to the work that they do. And the way in which those assumptions inform the interpretations that they provide. So basically, I started this in college, but certainly since I entered graduate school. I would say the benefit of history is that the assumptions are so much easier to see, right? There's a lot of overt declarations going on today as well, but I'll put that aside. But historically, they're a lot easier to see, but it's clear that they're not gone today. And so, to that extent, they're harder to identify. I continue to be wary, and my research supports that. But there are also so many more safeguards in place today than there were in the past. And so my wariness doesn't lead me to be to say that there's no legitimacy to the kinds of knowledge that is being produced today. And those safeguards, I would say, first and foremost, are in the great diversity in medical and scientific communities. So who's doing the research? Who's producing the knowledge? And the more diversity there is, the more likely it is that people will call each other out on the assumptions that they're making. And I would say peer review, for all its problems, is effective at pushing people to clarify what they're saying, what they mean, and to, again, call people out on just blanket assumptions about populations. And then I would also say that, we are engaged in robust conversations about race and class to some extent, not as much in this country as elsewhere. And these robust conversations raise people's awareness. So I would say I remain wary, but comfortable that we're catching that knowledge more often than in the past.
Yeah, I have to say that I share your enthusiasm for peer review. Despite all its faults, it's kind of amazing that it does seem to work to do some really good things. So on this issue of how you're thinking about scientific evidence, one of the things that you really underscore is that there's such an attention in the United States in particular to race, but what you're really pushing for is stronger attention to racism,
right,
in medicine as a real driver of disease. And in the third chapter, you're focusing specifically on how diabetes came to be more associated in the years, as you mentioned, after World War II with Black Americans, and how during the failed Reconstruction, when the promises of the U.S. government for the end of the Civil War just simply and, horribly didn't come through, that there were theories of Black Americans having racial immunity. And so these were some of the most sort of odiously racist ideas about the biological basis of health and of race as well. But then after that, it shifted to this notion of high rates of diabetes among Black Americans. And your question is for readers is not so much whether it was strictly accurate, but how on earth there could even be this kind of shift in the first place, and how the sorts of evidence that was coming up could simply not be seen, as in it just wasn't legible to the interpreters. And it brought to mind also Dan Bauch's work on how life insurance companies justified charging higher rates for Black Americans at this moment in time when there's a shift to notions of higher disease susceptibility. And you were mentioning how, one of the things that gives you courage around support for medical and scientific evidence around disease, sort of tempered support, is increasing racial diversity of science fields and healthcare practitioners in general. So to what extent do you feel like this is also a story about the medical profession and thinking especially about Black Americans? We read, for example, the Flexner Report in the past.
So to what extent do I feel like my book is saying something about the medical profession? Or to what extent is my hope for the future based on the changes that I see happening in the medical profession?
The former, whether the book is also partly tracing changes in who could be a healthcare provider.
Yeah, that's an interesting question. That was not a focus of my book. It's certainly the case that that those who really fought for those who fought to make diabetes visible in populations of color tended to be individuals from those populations who had managed to break into what had been primarily a white profession and advocate for people who look like them. And so in that third chapter of my book, where I talk about the invisibility of diabetes in the African American communities, what I point out is that African American practitioners were the first to really start drawing attention to increasing numbers, and And they were publishing in newspapers and some journals at the time. And what was really striking to me was the, I mean, not surprising, but striking, was how difficult it was for that idea that African-American individuals could also have diabetes, how hard it was for that to gain traction, or to use your language, for that to become legible, right? For that to be seen. And the only explanation that I could come up with was that the stereotypes were just so embedded that, and all the stories that had been told for decades about who got diabetes and why, just had created, there was just no space for seeing that these numbers were increasing. I mean, it has a lot to do too with, you know, where were people of color who had diabetes, where were they getting care? I mean, who was seeing them and who's publishing in the major journals? And so there was a kind of closed network that kept that knowledge out.
Yeah, that's such a great point about who was getting care from whom, who had access to care in the first place, and it also shows, as you just pointed out, the real stickiness of these stereotypes around diabetes as well. And here I want to hand it over to Ellie to build out on this.
Hi. So I had a question. Specifically, how is diabetes and the stereotypes it perpetuates different from those perpetuated by other diseases such as obesity or HIV and AIDS?
Yeah, so that was a really interesting question to think about, because obesity is easy. I would say there that it tracks stereotypes about diabetes, and it's a little bit hard to pull them apart. Obesity was also a sign of wealth. And so people who were larger tended to be people who had money. They could afford to indulge in a lot of eating, to live the high lifestyle. And as I already mentioned, Joslin considered diabetes to be a penalty of obesity. But he didn't consider obesity to be a disease, right? So this notion that obesity is a disease that circulates today, I actually think it would be really interesting to trace the emergence of it as a disease, and scholars have done that, but like the NIH didn't declare it to be a disease until 1998. So for most of the history of diabetes that I covered, diabetes and obesity were closely linked, but no one talked about obesity as a disease. So the tracking there is very close. With HIV/AIDS, the stereotypes are very different, and largely because HIV/AIDS is, the stories we tell there historically have been about sexuality and sexual preference. And as you all know, when we first became aware of HIV/AIDS, it was considered to be a gay disease, at least in this country. But I would say there also are some really interesting links between the two stories, because in the history of HIV/AIDS, invisible communities were also created, right? So we didn't see for a long time, or didn't pay attention to heterosexual transmission. Race is clearly part of that story as well, right? Because it was imagined initially primarily as a white disease. So in the early decades, it was invisible in communities of color. And then I would say the other interesting parallel to pursue would be the way in which, good and bad forms of the disease, or people who are innocent, right? So people who got HIV/AIDS from blood transfusions, right? They were innocent, versus individuals who pursued an active gay lifestyle, they were considered responsible or guilty. And certainly today we have that same dichotomy between individuals who have what we call type 2 diabetes and individuals who have what we call type 1 diabetes, where the sense is that it's not their fault, right? If you have type 1, it's not your fault. And then the assumption is if you have type 2, it is your fault. So I think there are interesting parallels. That was an intriguing question for me to think through. So thank you.
You also flag how the opioid crisis, thinking about like Ruha Benjamin's work on that as well, also maps onto this notion of when opioid epidemic was associated with Black Americans, there was a notion of victim blaming, as opposed to when it shifted to white Americans, it was much there. That's when the kind of structural interventions came in. And so thinking about the fourth chapter, you highlight the importance of the work going on in genetics. So tacking the actual scientific world and things that are happening onto how these disease categorizations with these cultural social stereotypes are working. And so in the 1960s, 1970s, there's work on the thrifty gene hypothesis, and the association of diabetes with Native American communities in really large numbers. And at the same time, the book, you also show a table which actually lists the different groups that are considered at high risk and very low risk. And they're all Native American communities in these different areas, but there's this insistence or this perpetual association of Native Americans with diabetes, even though it was some groups some of the time, and assuming that these categories have been made sense in the very first place. And what you write is that what this shows us is the responsibilization. So the notion of this being a form of bad diabetes and individual responsibility for changing lifestyle choices among Native American communities, as opposed to the U.S. government actually taking a look at and acknowledging and trying to repair the history of racist policies and lack of sovereignty claims acknowledgments with Native communities. So that was really interesting to see that track with the rise of genetics in the chapter. And then in the last chapter, chapter 5, you introduce you spend time with the Heckler report. So I'm wondering if you could just unpack that for us a little bit.
Just unpack the Heckler report?
Yeah. What would you want sort of the bullet points of that to be? Because you talk there about the division of diabetes into what is now familiar today of type 1 and type 2, those two categories being associated with minoritized versus white communities. And so how notions of race are really reaffirmed through the Heckler report.
Yeah, so, you know, the Heckler report was initiated with the best of intentions and actually ended up producing the Office of for the Study of Minority Health. So I don't want to, my intent is not just to diss it. And the other thing I would say about the Heckler report is that it was really a literature survey. So it was dependent on, it basically summarized all of the research that the task force had been able to get their hands on that had been studying racial health disparities for decades. And I should say, as an historian, that report was actually very helpful in leading me to some of the sources that were critical to my own research. What disturbed me about the report is that it there was clearly awareness on the part of the people writing this report that there were structural dimensions to the health disparities that they were uncovering. So I should just mention, in case you forgot, that the task force was charged to try to understand why health disparities were so great. So they, the government realized that, or recognized that the health of Americans was improving, but that not all populations were, their health, not the health of all populations was not improving equally. And so the task force was charged with trying to find out why. And what it did was this literature survey. And so in the introduction to the report, they show some awareness of social determinants of health. I mean, I won't go so far as to say structural racism, but they definitely showed some awareness of social determinants of health. But that was just in the survey volume. When you then went to each of the six diseases that it studied, it just disappeared. So that all of the conclusions that they drew ended up focusing on either the biology of the different populations that had such high rates, or the behaviors. So it just erased any awareness of social determinants of health, with structural inequalities. So I would say that, I mean, there are other things that really I find disturbing about the report, but that's the kernel.
Yeah. Here I want to hand it over to a tag team question. So Robert, could you sort of frame a question for us?
Yeah, so I was wondering, after reading your book, how do you want readers to now view categorizing health data in terms of race?
And related to that, Sam, can you hop in?
Yes, on a similar note, you discussed the historical mapping of social constructs like race onto medical diagnoses. And after reading your book, how would you like readers to view race as a tool to collect and categorize health data?
Yeah, so you probably all know this is a hotly debated area. And there are medical researchers who think we have to totally throw out the category of race, and others who argue very strongly that it has to stay in. And I think of myself as being somewhere in the middle ground. So I think it's really important that data around race or on race continue to be collected. I would just argue that that data needs to be seen as a window onto racism, that we look at this, when we see these racial disparities, that we see it as an indication of the way in which racism acts upon bodies, making people sick, rather than viewing race as some kind of biological or innate trait. My guess is that you don't encounter this much anymore, but the old sort of nature versus nurture debates that I grew up hearing about, much more complicated way of viewing race and racism, what makes it tricky is that racism does make people sick, right? So there are biological, physiological expressions that are linked to race. But what I think is really important is that we recognize that it is racism that is making people sick. If you think back to the first chapter of my book, that's actually the argument that Jewish physicians were making about why Jews had such high rates of diabetes, right? So, like, what does it mean? What did it mean for a Jewish physician in the 1920s to say, when anti-Semitism disappears, goes away, So will diabetes, right? And so I'm not saying that what I'm saying is what they were necessarily saying, but there is this link there. And then the only other thing is I would say that collecting data on race has to be complemented by collecting data on place and on class and environmental factors. And, you know, I'm sure you're all hearing about big data. And it seems to me that if we can, if we can get big data to coordinate information about biomarkers, and then why can't we apply it to collating information about what we loosely refer to as social and structural determinants of health? So,
yeah, that makes a lot of sense on this debate about using race to measure health disparities or to think about policy implications. I thought in the intro, you really nicely pulled pieces of both views where you said, yes, we do need to keep collecting data on race and health, but not for the reasons that people typically assign for that line of argument, but rather it's the other line of argument, which is that racism is one of the key drivers of health. And so you write that race has a direct effect on someone's health, but genetic differences, which may or may not exist, are not the primary reason for health disparities. Rather, health disparities reflect far more racism that populations experience because of the meanings ascribed to different skin colors and other physical attributes. So that was a really useful way of phrasing it and for us to be thinking about it. The piece that the book sort of brings up that has been sort of a bit sidelined relative to various racial categorizations associated with diabetes over the past 125 years is income and poverty and socioeconomic status. And this seems to be what you really have hope for in terms of meaningful understandings of all kinds of disease and the way that that also relates to racism in the United States. So for here to wrap us up, I want to hand it over to Corinne.
Yeah. What comments have you gotten about the book that have surprised you, like about the evidence you used or the connections you found?
So that's interesting. I thought that I would encounter more resistance from medical researchers. And I realized when I first started, my book came out in August of 2020. So what was it? Month five of the lockdown. And all my talks were on Zoom. And almost all my talks, I have to say, have been either to medical school departments, so medical researchers, clinicians, diabetes educators. I mean, those are the groups that have really been interested in hearing about my book. They didn't tend to read it before they invited me, right? I mean, they brought me in to give them the 35-minute, okay, what's the book about? So I thought I would get pushback, and it was quite the contrary. And I think that while in some ways it's been a disappointment to me that my book came out during the pandemic, in other ways it has been perfect timing because there was so much, because the pandemic really exposed the depth of structural racism in this country. And again, as an historian of medicine, I mean, neither Professor Stark nor I was surprised by any of that, but a lot of people in this country were, and there was a lot of soul searching going on among practitioners about the way in which their own training and their own practices might be contributing to or exacerbating the problems that they were trying to deal with. So, So that was one surprise, just how open people have been to the message. But that others, like I gave a talk to a pretty large group of diabetes educators, and they told me about how in their training they were taught about thrifty genes as though it was fact. I mean, they were just shocked when they read that chapter in my book. And so, you know, that was a little rewarding. I was surprised, but I'd say, you know, that was pretty rewarding. It's always nice when someone says, thank you. I just, you know, I learned so much from your work. And then the other one that's just a little funny is people keep saying how impressed they are with like all the research I did for the book. And I just want to say, well, this is what historians do. I don't know what to do with that. I think that some people in STEM seem to think that work in the humanities is easy compared to what is required of you in STEM subjects. I would just say, it's not, it's hard work and it takes a long time to do that research. So yeah, I think those are the surprises.
Well, we really appreciated, as you write in the book, that the stories we tell matter, and the ones we tell about race matter in very particular ways, especially when they're undergirded by notions of innocence and guilt. So we're really grateful to you for this book, which helped bring together so many things we've been thinking about and talking about this semester, and will definitely stay with us. So thanks so much.
You're welcome.